Thanks for listening to the Friday Live Extra from NET Radio, a weekly podcast featuring arts and humanities in Nebraska, and an online-only feature we produce in conjunction with our weekly radio show, Friday Live.
I'm Robert Goldberg, and on this week's podcast, I'm joined by Wendy Chun, who is the March 7 guest speaker on the Humanities on the Edge series, speaking at the Ethel S. Abbott Auditorium at the Sheldon Museum of Art. Each presenter's talk has been part of this year's theme for the series Post-Truth Futures. Wendy has also taught at Brown University and has been research chair in new media at Simon Fraser University School of Communication. She's also authored a trilogy of books on subjects related to new media, software, digital media, and more. Wendy, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Wendy, what subjects will you address in your lecture?
So I'm looking at the ways in which echo chambers are created online through algorithms and the effect that echo chambers have on the spread of misinformation.
Well, that's topical. That's must be the sort of cutting edge research about how this is happening. It's going on all over the place and in the media about everything, how it affects political events and whatnot. Tell us more about those echo chambers.
Well, what's key is that what people try to do is put you into a group with people whom you share a secret or a passion, whom you deviate slightly from the norm, like them, people you trust, and then inject stories that then get transferred amongst you and different sites that are related to it and repeated over and over and over again. But my question is less, when most people talk about fake news, they assume, okay, well, this is incorrect, it needs to be corrected. Mm-hmm. And if it was just corrected, then people would understand. But what's interesting about this is that a lot of people have shown that verification doesn't work. That in fact, if you correct stories, people will believe the incorrect story even more. Or if you spread a correction, you actually spread the fake news story.
It almost becomes like a conspiracy theory, perhaps, in the eyes of the person who believed the story originally.
It becomes a conspiracy theory, plus you actually broadcast the initial story to people who didn't hear it initially. And so part of my work is to ask, why do people find certain stories authentic? So people read literature all the time. They go to films. They know this is fictional, and yet they find it compelling and true. And so we need to ask ourselves, why and how do people find certain stories compelling and true, and under what circumstances do they come to spread them?
Wendy, how does your talk relate to the theme of post-truth futures?
So the argument is that to understand post-truth futures, you have to understand the past, so literature, et cetera, and the ways that operates. But we also have to understand the ways in which the future is created. So what's so interesting about these algorithms is that they're verified using past data. So for instance, a predictive algorithm, how do they know it's correct or not? Well, they hide data from the past and see how well the algorithm can predict the past. So they're not predicting the future, they're predicting the past, which means that in these algorithms, the future and the past coincide. Hmm. This is the most undisruptive notion of the future you can have.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It makes me think of, you know, stockbrokers who they go back and look at past histories of stocks and they use those to predict the future. Sometimes it works, sometimes it does. How do you find that looking back at the past, how accurately or inaccurately does it predict the future?
Well, that's the question. Often it doesn't. But what's interesting about these algorithms is that they also put in place the future, right? Mm-hmm. So these are predictive. They're also preemptive. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, they shape the future that emerges as well.
Part of your look at digital media involves online racial segregation. What is the race component and how does it make it different to look specifically at digital media as opposed to just race issues in culture in general?
So what's fascinating about network science is that one of the fundamental precepts of network science is called homophily. And it's the idea that birds of a feather flock together, that similarity breeds connection. Now, what's fascinating about this concept is that it was coined by Lazarsfeld and Merton, who were two sociologists, in 1954, and they were studying segregated yet biracial U.S. residential public housing. So the very notion of homophily, which grounds a lot of this work, comes from studies of U.S. residential segregation. Not only that, they assumed that homophily wasn't the only way friendships emerged. They also posited the term heterophily, the idea that opposites attract. Heterophily has since disappeared. But as well, in order to come up with the term homophily and to see that this was happening in this segregated yet biracial housing project, they actually threw out all the responses of Black residents.
As part of the study, as how they worked the experiment, so to speak.
As how they came up with the term homophily. So they asked the following questions. So how they came up with the term homophily was by saying that white liberals overselect white liberals and white illiberals overselect white illiberals. And they were basing this on two questions, which was, one, do you think races in the housing project get along? And secondly, do you think there should be biracial housing? So you were a liberal if you thought people got along and there should be biracial housing. And you were illiberal if you thought they didn't get along and there shouldn't be biracial housing. Now, all the Black residents thought that the races got along and there should be biracial housing. So in order to show this overselection, and the numbers would have been completely diluted had they, or and it would have been an entirely different picture had this been shown, they got rid of the completely ignored these responses.
Fascinating. And what about gender? Was that a part of the calculation in the research?
So when they were thinking through homophily, and again, this is really interesting research, and they were good people. They weren't meaning to do anything evil. They argued that the two strongest axes of homophily were gender and race. And the way they came up with this calculation was by asking people who their three closest friends were. Now, what's interesting is that also in the survey, they asked, do you have friends of the other race? And many people said, yes, we do. But they ignored all that by just focusing on that one question. So part of it is to say the past was different. There were all these other strands that could have been taken up. What would happen if we looked at those and modeled those?
And that's so topical now, you know, this idea of, oh, I have a friend of a different gender, of a different race, which by definition means I'm not a racist or I'm not a misogynist. But we know it's not nearly as simple as that. The speed of change in digital media, how we consume movies or television, make phone calls, listen to music, all of that has changed so quickly over the last 10 to 20 years. What effect do you think that has?
Well, I'm fascinated less by how things have changed and more by how things remain. So Friendster, do you remember Friendster?
Vaguely. It didn't last long.
It didn't last long, but the notion of friend has. Crackberries, remember?
No.
Yeah, so those are the blackberries.
Oh, right, when people would use them all the time.
Yeah, they were called crackberries. So crackberries are gone, but the notion of being addicted to a smartphone is still there. And so for me, what's more important is the ways in which certain habits have remained. And so what happens when we stop looking at the bleeding edge of obsolescence, but actually look at the ways these technologies and concepts remain within our bodies and within our interactions?
Well, Wendy Hee-Kyung Chun has been my guest. She is on this year's Humanities on the Edge speaker series. Those talks are at 5:30 p.m. at the Sheldon. Hers is March 7, and then the last in this year's series will feature Charlotte Biltkoff on April 18. Wendy, thanks for discussing this with me this week.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm Robert Goldberg.
The Friday Live Extra is a weekly podcast from NET Radio. Production help from Dave Hughes. Our theme music is by Alexios Anest. You can learn more about people and groups involved in arts and humanities in Nebraska by listening to Friday Live, broadcast statewide each week on NET Radio, streaming audio and video online at netnebraska.org, and also available as a podcast. I'm Genevieve Randall.